So imagine daring a room full of kids to like count how many times you say the name Jesus in a sermon.
Oh man, what a setup.
Right. And then immediately rapid firing the name. I think it was 14 times right in his opening prayer.
Yeah, he totally hijacked them.
He really did. That is exactly how Kent Wagner completely hijacked human nature this past Sunday. So, welcome to this special deep dive tailored specifically for you as you prep for your Connect group this week at Harmony Christian Church.
That's going to be a good one.
Oh, for sure. Because if you were there for our chaotic, just wonderful family fifth Sunday, where the kids and the youth joined us adults in the main service, you saw firsthand how brilliantly that icebreaker worked.
The kids were literally scrambling to keep count.
Yeah, and the adults realized they'd been completely played, so the hook was set.
Yeah.
But that playful moment was actually the entry point into a really deeply uncomfortable reality about how we are wired as humans. So our mission today is to unpack that tension, so you are fully loaded with insight for your small group discussion.
Well, and it was a brilliant setup because he didn't just stand up there and tell the room that serving is hard. He kind of trapped us in our own psychology.
Exactly.
Because the core tension he introduced is this thing we all theoretically know, but practically we absolutely hate.
Right, that Jesus insists the absolute prerequisite for greatness is taking the position of a servant.
Yes. And yet, every single fiber of our human biology and honestly, our sociology aggressively despises the idea of going backward on the social ladder.
I mean, let's look at the stories from his own life that he used to establish this to show that baseline resistance we all have.
Oh, the TV story.
Yes. The one that hit home for me was his childhood memory of being the human remote control.
For his parents' old box TV.
Right. And for anyone who didn't grow up in that era, TVs used to be these massive, heavy pieces of wooden furniture.
Just absolute units.
Yeah, with a clunky dial or these rigid plastic buttons. And his parents would be sitting there just exhausted, knees aching from a long day. And they'd just bark out, Kent, go change the channel.
And he'd have to get up and do it.
Right. So he'd run over, push the button, sit back down, and then like 2 minutes later.
Kent, go change the channel.
Exactly. He wasn't just the remote, he was the resident lemonade fetcher, the errand boy. And his visceral realization was that being constantly commanded to do these menial tasks didn't make him like a cheerful giver.
Not at all.
No, it made him actively resent serving.
And that resentment is completely natural when you look at the mechanics of human psychology. I mean, we have this fundamental need for autonomy.
Right.
So when someone else controls your time and your physical movements, your brain perceives it as a massive loss of agency.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, and he carried this thread into adulthood with the story of that demeaning early job. You remember where his boss essentially forced him to act as a personal assistant to the boss's teenage daughter.
Oh man, yeah, because the boss held the power over his wages, so Kent was just trapped running ridiculous errands for a teenager.
Which is incredibly demeaning.
Totally. And he also brought up the visual of picky restaurant customers, like the ones who demand their peas be served on a separate little plate.
Yes, the pea plate.
If you look closely at the waiter's eyes in those moments, you just see this defeated, soul-crushing exhaustion. But here's where I kind of want to push back on this whole concept.
Okay, let's hear it.
So, from a purely practical survival standpoint, isn't that aversion to being at the bottom completely justified?
Well, yeah, in a way.
Like, if I don't climb the corporate ladder, I can't provide for my family. If I don't secure some kind of status, I don't have the resources to fund the church or help my community.
It's a fair point.
Right. Ambition isn't inherently evil. So, when Kent says being a servant stinks, isn't there a real danger in romanticizing the lowest position to the point where we just become, I don't know, entirely ineffective in the real world?
See, that is the exact friction that makes this topic so difficult. Because you are absolutely right about the survival mechanism. Evolutionary psychology tells us that status equals access to resources. When you are at the top of a hierarchy, you're protected. But when you serve someone else, you're expending your own limited time, energy, and resources with absolutely zero guarantee of getting anything back.
So it's a risk.
A huge risk. To your brain, willingly lowering your status feels like a literal threat to your survival. You become vulnerable to the whims of whoever is above you.
Like the boss with the teenage daughter.
Exactly like that. Our brains are hardwired to hoard power, so we never have to experience that kind of vulnerability.
Which honestly makes the scene in Matthew 18 that much more abrasive.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if our brains are wired to hoard status for survival, the disciples were really just acting on raw human instinct.
Yeah, they were just being guys.
Right. They're in Capernaum, which is this bustling fishing town right off the Sea of Galilee. They're sitting up on a hill, and they bring Jesus this burning question. They say, you know, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?
They want the org chart.
Exactly. They're looking at this new kingdom Jesus is building, and they're essentially asking for the corporate promotion criteria. They want to know how to secure their resources in this new administration.
Well, and to understand their mindset, you really have to look at the massive Roman influence in first century Judea.
Right, because it was everywhere.
Yeah. Society operated heavily on this patron-client system. You wanted to align yourself with a powerful patron who would offer you protection and resources.
Like a sponsor.
Exactly. And in return, you offered them your absolute loyalty. But the ultimate goal of a client was to gain enough status so that you could eventually become a patron to someone beneath you.
Oh, wow. So it's just an endless ladder.
Yes. And the disciples are looking at Jesus as the ultimate patron. They're trying to position themselves as his top-tier clients so they can eventually have people serving them.
They want the corner office.
They really do.
And then Jesus just shatters that entire framework. I mean, he doesn't point to a powerful Roman centurion or a wealthy merchant or even a religious scholar as the model of success. He pulls a small child into the middle of the room.
Yeah, such a wild move.
And Kent painted this picture so vividly. He talked about standing in a prayer circle earlier that Sunday morning between two giant burly guys from the men's group and feeling completely dwarfed.
Yeah, that was a great visual.
It was. He told us a picture of this little kid suddenly pulled into the center of a group of giant, rough, weather-beaten fishermen whose hands are calloused from hauling nets. I mean, these are the guys a kid usually tries to avoid.
And Jesus squats down to this child's eye level and delivers just a crushing blow to their ambition. Mm-hmm. He says, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven.
Just brutal for their egos.
Totally. And then he establishes the new metric for greatness in verse 4. He says, therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven.
But I feel like the gravity of that statement doesn't really land for us today without pulling apart the historical context.
No, it really doesn't.
Because the way we view kids today in like modern American culture is drastically different from a first century fishing village. Uh-huh. Today, we elevate children. We helicopter parent them.
Oh, for sure.
We give them whatever they want when they throw a tantrum in the middle of a grocery store. Kent made that joke that got a ton of amens from the teachers in our congregation.
Oh, I heard that.
Yeah, he said today, if a kid acts out in class, the parents automatically blame the teacher. We treat children like royalty.
But in the ancient Greco-Roman world, the dynamic was entirely inverted. Children were not idolized at all. They were considered incomplete adults.
Wait, incomplete?
Yeah. Under Roman law, there was this concept of patria potestas, which means the power of the father. And it meant that the head of the household had absolute legal power over his children. They were practically property.
Wow. Literally property.
Yes. They had zero societal influence, no economic power, no rights. Like Kent reminded us, they couldn't work a trade, they couldn't buy a house, they couldn't drive a chariot.
Right. The chariot joke?
Yeah. They were completely dependent and utterly ignorable. Their primary function was to be seen and not heard, which admittedly got a big laugh and an amen from the older folks in our service.
Oh, yeah, it definitely did.
But the reality of a child's life back then was just complete powerlessness.
So Jesus isn't just telling these ambitious grown men to be like innocent or pure.
Not at all.
He is literally commanding them to willingly strip themselves of their hard-earned social currency. Mm-hmm. He's telling guys who are trying to claw their way up the ladder to intentionally adopt the social standing of property.
To become the remote control.
Yes, to become the remote control. That isn't just humbling. In a ruthless society like the Roman Empire, it sounds like career suicide.
It is the ultimate system shock. Because Jesus is demanding downward mobility.
Downward mobility. Wow.
But giving up that social currency creates a massive vacuum. Because if we are no longer spending our energy protecting our own status and climbing over each other for resources, what are we supposed to do with all that time and energy?
Right.
And that is the exact question that reshapes our entire understanding of what it means to be a church.
Which brings us to the core theology of the ongoing sermon series at Harmony Ecclesia. the Greek word for church.
Right.
Kent explained that it literally means the called out ones. We are called out of the exhausting cycle of making ourselves the center of the universe, but we aren't just called out into a void, you know?
No, not at all.
We are called into the practice of sacrificing our lives for others.
And the etymology of ecclesia is super fascinating here. Because in ancient Greece, an ecclesia was a political assembly of citizens who had been called out from their homes to make decisions for the city.
So it was like a VIP club.
Exactly. It was a gathering of privilege. You had to have a certain status to be there.
Yeah.
But Jesus commandeers this political word for privileged citizens and completely redefines it.
He flips it.
Totally. His ecclesia is an assembly defined by service, not privilege.
It is such a stark contrast to the American dream. I mean, the American dream tells you to walk into a crowded room and shout your resume at the top of your lungs so everyone knows how important you are.
Yeah, build your brand.
Right. But the ecclesia tells you to walk into a quiet room, grab a towel, and start washing the dirt off someone else's feet. And Kent pointed to the ultimate blueprint for this in Philippians chapter 2.
Yes.
Jesus possessed the very nature of God. He had the ultimate cosmic status. Like, if anyone had the right to demand that humanity act as his human remote control, it was him.
Absolutely.
But he didn't use that status as a weapon to demand worship. He willingly emptied himself, took the nature of a servant, and got on his knees.
And the theological term for that is kenosis, the self-emptying of Christ.
Kenosis.
He didn't just pretend to be a servant. He genuinely surrendered his privileges. And Kent brought this ancient theological concept right into the lobby of Harmony Christian Church with a statement that, honestly, should entirely change how we view Sunday mornings.
Oh, this part was so good.
He said, "The person who poured your coffee this morning is more important than the guy standing on the stage preaching. Going up requires going down."
That one hit hard. We are so conditioned to look at the platform, you know, the microphone, the spotlight, and we just automatically associate that with spiritual success.
Yeah, we can't help it.
But if greatness is measured by how low you are willing to go, the hierarchy of the church is completely inverted. And to show us what this actually looks like in practice, Kent didn't just rely on ancient texts. He took us to the Yum Center.
Complete with his incredible disappointment that an arena named Yum somehow doesn't offer free Kentucky Fried Chicken.
A tragic missed opportunity for sure. I feel for him. But he was there to see Forrest Frank perform in front of 20,000 screaming fans.
Yeah.
And if there is anywhere that the human ego is supposed to run wild, it is center stage at a massive arena concert. The entire music industry is basically built on that patron-client system we were just talking about. Worship the headliner, and maybe you get to be part of the entourage.
But Kent noticed that Forrest, his physical posture on stage, completely rejected that system.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Instead of making himself the focal point, Forrest placed a massive cross at the center of the stage, and the entire band actually faced inward toward it, rather than outward toward the audience.
That is so rare.
And at one point, Forrest pulled a kid up to the microphone.
Oh, the kid who couldn't sing.
Yes. The kid was apparently a genuinely terrible singer. But instead of rushing him off stage to, like, protect the production value of the show, Forrest just stopped the show, put his arm around him, and prayed over him in front of 20,000 people.
Wow.
And then later, he yielded his own stage to another artist, Corey Asbury, and went over to a dark, unlit corner of the stage. Kent just watched Forrest standing in the shadows with his hands raised, worshiping to Amazing Grace while someone else took his spotlight.
Just incredible. But how a person reaches that level of ego death on such a massive platform is really the story. And Ken peeled back the curtain on how Forrest Frank even ended up in the Christian music industry to begin with.
Right, because he didn't start there.
No. Many people might know Forrest from his time in a highly successful secular band called Surfaces. They had that massive viral TikTok hit Sunday Best.
Oh yeah, that song was everywhere.
Everywhere. He was at the peak of secular fame making serious money, but he was wrestling with this intense internal calling to leave it all behind and write music exclusively for God.
Which is a terrifying career leap.
Absolutely terrifying. So he was at a church in Texas, just hiding up in the balcony, trying to pray through this massive life decision in complete anonymity.
And enter Morgan.
Enter Morgan.
Morgan is a girl from Washington, D.C., who had this deeply bizarre experience the night before. She had a dream where God told her she needed to find a specific guy named Forrest and deliver a very specific message.
And she didn't even know him.
No. She had no idea who Forrest was, didn't know anything about his band, didn't know what industry he was in. But she obeyed. She went to the church, asked the pastor, found Forrest hiding up in that balcony, and just walked up to a total stranger. She told him he was supposed to leave secular music and that God was going to use him to completely change the Christian industry.
Imagine the social risk Morgan took in that moment. Walking up to a stranger in a balcony based on a dream requires abandoning your need to look normal or sane or respectable.
Completely.
She had no platform, no guarantee that Forrest wouldn't just laugh her out of the room, and no promise of any credit. It was an act of pure, vulnerable service.
She was willing to take the lowest social position, the weird girl with a dream, simply to serve what God was doing in someone else's life.
And her willingness to be socially awkward for 3 minutes literally altered the trajectory of his life, which has now impacted millions of people. And that led to Kent's massive challenge to our congregation. He looked right at us and said, "Everybody wants to be Forrest. Nobody wants to be Morgan."
That is such a heavy quote.
It is. But here is my question for you as you think about your Connect group this week. Are we so obsessed with the idea of doing great things for God, getting the platform, seeing the visible impact, being recognized, that we completely write off the small, seemingly insignificant moments of obedience?
That's a great question.
Because if we are terrified of being Morgan, we will never see the Forrest Franks of the world step into their calling.
And the harsh reality is that, yeah, God occasionally calls someone to the spotlight, but he is almost certainly calling the vast majority of us to be Morgans,
yeah,
to do the invisible work, to prioritize the spiritual growth of the person sitting next to us over our own legacy. Being Morgan is kind of the modern equivalent of becoming like the child in Capernaum.
Exactly. And that is where the rubber meets the road for us at Harmony this week. Sometimes being a Morgan doesn't mean flying across the country to deliver a prophetic word to a future pop star.
Usually it doesn't.
Right. As Kent beautifully pointed out, sometimes it just means leaning over to the squirming, distracted kid next to you in the pew and quietly whispering the worship lyrics to them because they haven't learned how to read yet.
Yeah.
It means sacrificing your own uninterrupted worship experience so that a child can participate.
It's those micro decisions to lower your own status for someone else's benefit. And Kent modeled this perfectly at the end of the service because giving an altar call can be incredibly intimidating for people who are hurting.
Oh, for sure. Walking down the aisle in front of hundreds of people requires so much vulnerability.
Right. But Kent reminded the room that if you are too embarrassed to walk to the front, you don't have to. You just have to make eye contact and wave down an altar worker, and they will leave the front, walk up the aisle, and come serve you right in your seat.
They come to you.
Yeah. They take the lowly position to make sure the hurting are cared for.
They become the human remote control.
Yeah.
They fetch the lemonade. It is such a beautiful, tangible picture of what the ecclesia is supposed to be.
It really is.
So, as you head into your Connect group to discuss all of this, let's wrap up with something to chew on. We started by talking about how our survival instincts demand that we climb the ladder, secure our status, and just avoid the lowly position at all costs. But Jesus flips the ladder and says greatness is found at the very bottom.
You have to become the child. You have to be Morgan.
But if we actually commit to this, if we step into the shadows and dedicate our lives to quiet, invisible service, it introduces a brand new, incredibly tricky problem. So here is the thought I want you to wrestle with in your small groups this week.
Lay it on us.
What do you do when your quiet service starts getting recognized? If you become known and celebrated in your church community for being a humble Morgan, haven't you just accidentally built a brand new platform? How do you outrun the human ego once it realizes that humility is the new currency?